Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We made this.
Sing it, Sam.
You must remember this.
You must remember this. Sometimes the best songs start in the middle of a story. They engage you in the space of a few choice words. Maybe it's the way Springsteen piques your interest with "The screen door slams, Mary's dress waves." As if we know Mary. As if we know why there is conflict there. As if we slammed the door. We're hooked. Maybe it starts with a statement of intent, like the Spice Girls, "In Your Face," declaring, "Yo, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want." So brash for a first line on a debut single. Tell me more, women of Spice. Tell me more. "You must remember this," tells us, right from the start of this song, the now immortal "As Time Goes By," as sung by Dooley Wilson, that there's a story already, a history, and it's worth remembering. In fact, you must. And you know what? He's right. For Rick and Ilsa, their story started way before they were unexpectedly reunited in Morocco. But before we can learn about that, we learn about Rick, a man hardened by something in his life, a cold shell of a human, stubbornly neutral on every subject. He doesn't join anyone for a drink. He does not engage in politics, even surrounded by soldiers and refugees in the shadow of some of the most atrocious acts by any government in modern history. He stoically refuses to engage. But some things will shake even the most hardened of Switzerlands. Fascism and the abuse of human rights are a couple of those things. Love is another. Rick and Ilsa, lovers in Paris, have their romance truncated by war circumstances. They know little of each other's past. It's deliberate. They've chose that way. But Rick cannot stay in Paris for fear of being killed by the approaching Germans in grey. Ilsa, in blue, cannot leave with him. And Rick never found out why. Their bond broken, as are their hearts. Only love can repair a broken heart. Only love can break a heart that badly in the first place. 80 years after it was made, Casablanca still has us caring an absurd amount about Victor, Ilsa, Rick, and their hill of beans. So stick around to join me and Dan Rice as we celebrate its 80th movieversary. Welcome to Movieversaries, an official We Made This podcast network show. I'm your host, Bo Nicholson. Movieversaries is a show where we celebrate the anniversaries of some of the greatest films ever made. On this episode, we're discussing Casablanca, a Michael Curtiz film about love, sacrifice, friendship, war, and a sex pest chief of police who is still strangely one of the most endearing characters in the history of American cinema on its 80th anniversary. To help me discuss the film, I'm joined by Dan Rice from Good Moves TV and Breeder, who appears to have become addicted to talking to me about old movies. Dan, Happy New Year.
Happy bloody New Year, mate. Yes, it's become one of my great new addictions, chatting to you about movies.
I'm sorry that it's caused an addiction of sorts, but, you know, as far as addictions go, it doesn't seem that unhealthy, I suppose.
Yeah. I've had worse addictions. It's fine.
Today we're talking about, as I've mentioned, Dan, Casablanca, one of the great films directed by Michael Curtiz. He was best known at the time for directing the wonderful The Adventures of Robin Hood. I don't know if you managed to catch that one. It had Errol Flynn in it in 1938.
No, definitely not.
It's fantastic. He was a Hungarian man who made some films in Austria, Germany, Hungary, before moving to America in 1926. It stars Humphrey Bogart, fresh after starring in The Maltese Falcon. It also has Ingrid Bergman, Paul Henreid, and Claude Rains. It's a film that made about $1 million... Sorry, it was made for about $1 million, making 10 times that at the box office. Has a Metascore of 100, but, you know, I mean, basically, it's a perfect film. It won 3 Oscars, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, was nominated for a bunch of others as well, including cinematography, editing, and music. In 2006, the WGA's announced it was the greatest screenplay ever written. That was, of course, 12 years before Bohemian Rhapsody was released, though. Timing is everything.
Yeah. It's okay. Like, some giants have to topple.
And it is routinely very near the apex of any list of the greatest movies ever. Hmm. And it came in at number 84 in the Sight of Sound Greatest Movies Ever, which I think is the greatest list ever put together, except for my own, which it comes in the top 10 in mine. So, Dan, what does Casablanca mean to you?
It's a very, very beautiful film. And for me, there are a lot of wonderful memories attached to it. Not so much of like what was going on in my life or anything like that, but just the amount of times I've enjoyed this film. So I try to watch this at least once a year. And I think we didn't watch it together the first time, did we?
I don't think so. I was trying to rack my brain about this because usually I have a really strong memory of the first time I see a movie. But this one, I actually don't have that strong a memory. I was trying to work out if we watched it in film TV class back at school, but maybe we didn't.
I think we saw scenes because I have that very good memory of our film and TV teacher, Mr. Murray, talking about little hints that people put into films. And he's talking about the transit papers. And he's like, you know, when Rick hides the transit papers, it's one shot and you never see it. It's never explained where he does it. He just sort of walks over to the piano, puts the transit papers down, it holds for a second, and then it cuts. And he was just like, just talking about how subtle this film was with that little factoid.
So we obviously saw like little scenes of it before we actually came across the movie. And actually, another example, another scene, I remember Muzz, Mr. Murray, hope he's well, he used to talk about how some great films or famous film directors would kind of hide the identity of the protagonist until a certain point to sort of help build the mystery of the person. And he showed us Raiders of the Lost Ark where Indiana Jones is mostly in shadow until like the big face reveal. In Casablanca, we hear about Rick. It's Rick's cafe. We know where we are. We hear about him. We see him signing his own name and then it pops up to his face. Little things like that. So I do remember little glimpses in film TV, but I don't think I saw it until after that. I would have been maybe 18 or 19 because that's when I saw a whole bunch of these sort of movies. Were you probably the same?
Probably about the same. Yeah. I think I got it for the first time. I may have actually just bought it on Blu-ray and I have this very distinct memory of just an extremely hot summer at my mum's house in Kingston, where she couldn't afford air conditioning. So I just sat on the ground because she had this like linoleum floor and it was the coolest part of the house. So I lay on the floor, popped on this movie, watched it, trying to eat a bit of chocolate. But I remember looking down, the chocolate had melted. And I'm like, well, that's gone. watched it through once. And I was just like, that was amazing. And I just like hit play again and just watched it again.
Wow. That's a pretty rare thing, right? The ability to watch a movie. It's 102 minutes in length in this country and in most countries. It was 82 minutes in length in West Germany, which I find fascinating.
Really? Like,
what 20 minutes did they knock out of this movie?
Interesting.
I'd have to look into that, I think. But
what year was that cut back? Was it at the time?
I think so, yeah. Like, for the actual theatrical release.
Yeah.
West Germany being... Well, actually, no. In West Germany, it would have been years later because Germany was still unified at the time of release. Obviously, it was under the Nazi reign. So, yeah, I'm not sure when that was cut back. But 20 minutes gone. I mean, maybe it was, like, a lot of the stuff about the German regime. Like, maybe when they sing...
What's the name of that German song?
Yeah, it's like
Die Wacht am Rhein.
Yes, I think. Yes, Die Wacht am Rhein. Yeah.
Like maybe that scene was cut out when they sing over the top of them with Marseillaise. I don't know, but yeah, fascinating that you were able to watch a movie for longer than an hour and a half, and then just sit there and go, shit, here we go again, you know?
It was just so incredible. I've never really done that with films. Like, I always like to think I would. I'll watch it and I'll just watch it again. Never. I've never done that before. But with this, I would watch it over and over again.
My example of that is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I remember watching that for the first time. I think I started it at, like, maybe 9 p.m. at night. I remember... which room I was in, like which TV I was watching it on. It was through my Xbox on a DVD, and it would have finished, you know, almost midnight or something like that. And I think my intention was to watch it for a bit and then get really tired and like, who knows if I finished it or not. And then I finished it and then I watched it again immediately at like midnight-ish until about 2 a.m. or something.
Yeah.
Such was the brilliance of that movie. So, I mean, that's also in my personal top 10. So, we're talking about some pretty esteemed kind of territory here.
Yeah.
You're less of a list maker than me, but does Casablanca sit pretty high in your esteem?
Yeah, extremely so. Like, it's very high up. I do not keep lists. But it is one of my all-time favorite films. Like, there's so many wonderful things about this. Like, no matter how many times I've seen it, watching Rick and Ilsa see each other again, like for the first time in the cafe, always brings me to tears. Every time I hear As Time Goes By for the first time, I'm in tears. I laugh at everything. Like, no matter how many times I watch this film, it's just like, it feels like the first time I've seen it.
It is. It's amazingly fresh for a movie that's 80 years old, and hence why we're celebrating it today. It really retains a lot of that impact, doesn't it? I mean, it's very much of its time. I mean, it's a studio film. I don't know how many of those extras on the Blu-ray that you watched, but all of them, yeah. even Carrot Blanca, was that on there as well?
I did. That was great. It's actually brilliant.
Very, very funny.
Yeah.
They talk about the idea that Warner Brothers didn't really see this as any sort of particularly special movie. It was more as a vehicle of a couple of things, really, like to appease Roosevelt's needs for American propaganda movies, essentially, at that time, and to appease the need to turn Humphrey Bogart into a romantic leading man, which he hadn't been previously. And they were making like 50 movies a year at that studio, so it was nothing particularly special going on.
Warner Brothers in particular, right? They were like the workhorse studio of the time.
Yes, very much so. With Hal B. Wallace being the sort of the overarching producer of a number of films, just working himself to the bone until A Slight, essentially, where he was, I don't know if you read about this, but when this movie received the Best Picture Oscar, usually the producer is the one that receives that award. And the producer is usually the first on stage to receive the statue. And Jack Warner, being the studio head, beat him to the stage and received the statue first, which Hal B. Wallace, as producer, took as this massive slight and very soon after left Warner Brothers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, pretty big deal because he was a producer. Like, he was essentially a wunderkind, what he did at that studio. But it very much is a movie of its time, right? It's an American propaganda movie in the middle of World War II. We don't know if the Nazis are going to win. We don't know if America's going to win. When this movie's being made, we don't even know if America's going to really earnestly join the war or not.
Yeah, I think it's something like just before production, the Pearl Harbor bombings happened, like the attack on Pearl Harbor. So, it was just on the cusp of the US joining World War II.
And then, of course, they do. And, you know, the rest is well-known history. But so, it is very much a film of its time. But it does hold a lot of cultural value 80 years later. And to sort of throw around our run sheet a little bit, I wondered if we could sort of talk about the influence of the movie and what it sort of had on the culture and its medium. Because this, as I said, it's regarded as maybe one of like the top 5 or 10 like quintessential American films. And I think it's well earned. What is it What sort of influence do you see or that it's had on culture, on people, on films generally?
I'd say the biggest thing is with quotes, right? Like, there's so many quotes from this film that have, I mean, maybe it's slowly going out of fashion now, but, like, it's so part of the vernacular. Like, he's looking at you, kid. Yeah. This is the start of a beautiful friendship. Like, all these things, we just know. We've known this since we were born. Basically, that's just been the biggest thing. It's been parodied so many different times, and it's just so a part of our culture.
AFI made a list of the best 100 quotes, AFI being the American Film Institute. Not the band, no.
That would be great.
Did you get into them? You would have got into them.
Hell yeah.
That was more your flavor than mine from memory. Yeah. You were a bit of an emo kid in like when you were 16 years old.
As soon as they released Miss Murder, they were like too cool and we had to like step away from them.
That's right. I remember that. I remember half kind of liking that song, which means that I was not an emo kid for sure. I was a heavy metal kid back then. Do you remember that shit?
Yeah. Suburban metalhead.
With my mum.
Yeah, with your mum. Fuck yeah. Fuck, you're a badass.
But in that list of the 100 greatest quotes according to the Miss Murder band AFI, there was 6 of them came from Casablanca, and I will quiz you on this later on because I want to see how many of them you reckon are worthy for one, but also which ones you can guess. You may have already got 2 already. but in terms of, they were all American films. It's the American Film Institute, but Casablanca had the most in that list. The next closest was Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz, which both had 3. There's No Place Like Home, like stuff like that, you know. Like, Frankly, My Dear, I Don't Give a Damn. I think that came in at number 1.
Yeah.
And this one had 6 quotes that sort of live amongst that and has permeated culture since. You talk about the imitations. I'm really glad that one imitation didn't happen. There was in the mid-2000s, so we're talking about like a 40-year-old Madonna. She was campaigning essentially and pitched to a whole bunch of studios that Madonna herself would play Ilsa and Ashton Kutcher in the mid-2000s. So a young Ashton Kutcher would play Rick.
Mm-hmm.
And she was pitching this to a lot of people. I think she was with Guy Ritchie at the time. So she maybe probably thought that Guy Ritchie would direct.
And oh my God.
Like, man, that just sounds, I mean, like, I don't mind Guy Ritchie at sometimes. Fuck, that sounds horrible. I'm so glad that the studios had the good sense to turn that down.
Oh my God. Yeah. No, that sounds awful. Like to take such like a beautiful, like melodrama, like that's what it is. It's very much a melodrama. And then slap Guy Ritchie on it and Madonna.
And Ashton Kutcher.
Oh my God. Yeah, no. And like an interesting thing about this film is like it was remade so many different times, never to such a great effect as the original. So there was like a TV special that was made in like the 50s, I think. There was an actual TV series that I think was also made in the 50s.
Yeah, and they tried it again in the early 80s as well, didn't they?
Yep. Just a straight remake. I think different, you know, it wasn't set during World War II and everything like that. They tried to modernize it. Apparently it was crap. And then Carrot Blanca, which is just phenomenal. And like, if you watch that, it is just like a perfect way to summarize a story. Like, it is a masterwork in getting like a 2-hour film down to what, 10 minutes?
7 minutes. Yeah.
Oh my God. It is just perfect.
Yeah. It really is a wonderful piece of parody, but yeah, summation, right?
Yes.
And efficiency and just like, you know, using some of the most iconic cartoon characters of all time to play some of the most iconic film characters of all time. Like, we talk about like iconography. Is there a more iconic romantic duo in a film than Bogart's Rick and Bergman's Ilsa? Like, they're right near the top, aren't they?
It's just such a beautiful meshing of films. And like I always say about a good film or a great film, it needs to be a mix of things. Like, it can't just be a straight horror. It can't just be a straight action. Like, it's got to have, like, the action, the intrigue, the comedy, like the love, like it just mixes everything together and just somehow makes it work. And this is like a perfect example of a film that does that. Like you've got, and I think it also speaks to like the troubled story of its production, pre-production through to production, how many writers were attached to this film. Mm. Like it started off as a stage play. It's written by Murray Burnett. He wrote this after a journey, a holiday through Europe. He saw signs of what Germany of the time had to offer the world, and he was a little bit freaked out. But he also visited a bar, and there was like a jazz pianist who was singing and performing in front of this crowd that had like Nazis and like French soldiers and a whole mixed bag of people. And he was just like, oh, I'm going to write this play that's set in a bar that features this mixed bag of people. And then that script was then adapted by the Epstein brothers.
Yeah, and Howard Koch as well, who sort of chimed in with some stuff.
Well, I think it was very interesting. So Julius and Philip were brought on specifically for their strength in dialogue, writing witty dialogue. And so they had like a pass of the script. And then Howard Koch was brought on to sort of rewrite more of the dramatic sections of the script.
Mm-hmm.
And they were writing in tandem. Like their own versions of the script. And I believe it was Koch and Curtiz disagreed on story points. Like Curtiz just really wanted to focus on the romance, and Koch wanted to focus more on like the political intrigue and, you know, the war, like the bigger things at the time. And maybe that somewhere they landed somewhere in the middle. And maybe because of that the amount of like disagreements that they had such a beautiful mix of styles within this film.
Yeah, like I mean, like you probably attribute the credit to that wonderful La Marseillaise scene where they sing, you know, the French national anthem, which was, you know, created not long after the French Revolution. So that's a war march, you know, a chant, you know, like that's such a powerful song. You'd probably attribute the credit to that scene to Howard Koch, right? Given that knowledge. Also Casey Robinson was another writer who wanted to reject credit essentially, which basically meant that they didn't get an Oscar. But they wrote the love scenes as well. So you've got the love scenes, the political drama, and the dialogue all being written by different people at different times, which was very much the style of studios back in the day. You'd remember that we watched Mank together, how Herman Mankiewicz, who later wrote Citizen Kane, was essentially just part of this writer's pen, you know, at MGM with 10 other people, and they would just make these movies together. So again, it sort of speaks to the whole there's nothing special about Casablanca.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
But through just this wonderful confluence of events, it became this amazingly special thing.
Yeah, and like you said that it won the Oscar for what, best screenplay?
Yeah.
And that's insanity for something that was like not even finished before they started shooting.
Yeah.
You know, they were rewriting dialogue the day before a scene. Like it's crazy. And I think it's a real film that pokes a hole into the idea of the auteur cinema. So the idea that there's like the director, writer, who is the one visionary throughout the whole thing.
Yes.
This film is such a mixed bag of things. Like you've got so many people pulling at it from different directions. You've probably got Warner, you know, trying to have his own agenda. You've got Curtiz trying to be like, you know, apparently he doesn't know much about story. He was all about like action and visual. And you've got the writers with their own agendas and everyone's pulling in different directions. And somehow they made this beautiful, beautiful film. It totally casts out the idea of the auteur.
Yeah, you're right about that. And like a lot of my favorite movies are auteur films. But like this is the antithesis, isn't it? this is the perfect example of what a studio film can do. And has probably, I mean, there's a bunch of other examples like Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, but I would posit that Gone with the Wind hasn't aged quite as well as Casablanca. Wizard of Oz probably has, okay. So there's a bunch of movies that are made in that studio time that didn't age particularly well, even though they were classics of their time. But this one found some universality in there, in those themes, right? Mm-hmm. One theme I still really draw to is the idea of sacrifice, the idea of the greater good, the idea that things are more important than, say, money, mm-hmm. like loyalty and friendship. Like when Sam refuses to play for Ferrari, even though he would earn a lot more money, he prefers the friendship that he has with Rick. And that was quite progressive at that time, to be honest. Like, it probably plays a little bit like, oh, look, the black guy working for the white guy now. But at that time, it was very, like, it's coming hot off the heels of Gone with the Wind, which was, you know, very different. Like, very different.
Max racism.
They were essentially business partners in a sense. Yeah. And, you know, Rick never makes any sort of references to Sam's skin color or anything like that. So, his skin color essentially becomes a non-issue in this movie, which is fascinating in the early 40s.
Yeah.
20 years before civil rights.
Yeah, there are some little hints to it you see. Like, Ilsa refers to what's the musician's name?
Sam? Oh, yes. Sam as boy.
As the boy. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's another funny thing in Carrot Blanca. You've got that classic. So Bugs Bunny as Rick and Daffy Duck as Sam. And Rick's just like waiting at the train station for Ilsa and Sam runs in with all his bags. It's just like... kind of like his like personal servant. I was like,
yes, yeah.
Oh, very good, Carrot Blanca. Very good. Very subtle.
Carrot, you know, Carrot Blanca. And I mean, it happens in the film as well, right? Where Sam is the one lugging around the stuff in the rain while Rick is ushered onto the train reluctantly and then slumps against the window.
Yeah.
Or the door, rather. You know, like, yeah, okay, there is certainly an element of white guy above black guy in this movie, but it is a lot more progressive than other films at that time, for sure. But like, you know, friendship and loyalty is more important than money in that case.
Mm-hmm.
Love is more important than just about anything, but above all else is the greater good and the sacrifice that comes from that. And what with that, I can't remember exactly, but I think it was Roger Ebert that said that in some way they've sort of ascended to the ranks of the gods, you know, like humans don't make those sort of sacrifices.
Mm.
We wish we could. We idealize ourselves that way. But Rick and Ilsa and Laszlo do.
Mm.
They do sacrifice their ideals and what they want and what they love at different times for the greater good. And it's just so fascinating to watch that unfold. And I think that is what gives the movie its legs 80 years later.
Yeah.
Apart from the wonderful witty dialogue, it's that theme of wanting to be the best version of ourselves, to want to have that love, but be strong enough to know what's best for the world and sacrifice for that. You know, like we all want to be Rick, Ilsa, and Laszlo in that way.
Like I'm sure every man wants to be Rick and be able to be this strong character who's dark and brooding, but can make the right decision, the right moral decision for the greater good when the chips are down.
Do you see the American propaganda very, very clearly in this film?
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, it's so spelled, like it's, of course, like it's extremely, it's very much a propaganda film. Like there's no dancing around it.
How does that make you feel?
Totally fine. It is a thing of its time. Like it's so many, just because a thing is propaganda or it's what, well, it's whatever needed to happen for this thing to be made.
Mm-hmm.
Like it doesn't matter if it was made for that purpose, whatever. It's still a beautiful film. It's still a beautiful human story. It's not a bad propaganda film where you sort of, you look at it and you just see, oh, there's shallow characters and whatever. There's just this, like, you know, American hero A and German, you know, villain B. Like, everyone is very well-rounded and very interesting characters. It's just, sure, it might be a propaganda film, but it's almost just like it's the wrapper. It's just what it needed to have is like its coating for it to exist. And it's like, cool, we've got that. We've made it a propaganda film, whatever. But we really want to tell the story of the time and of this romance between these two people and greater human values.
I'd be very curious to read Everybody Comes to Rick's, the original play, which was never made, or at least it wasn't before the film, and to see how much of that sort of translates from the page to the screen, because it's very obvious on the screen that it's American. I mean, you could almost say that Rick himself is meant to represent America. He's the only American character in the film that I can think of. Everybody else is from Europe and or Africa. And so it's like he, at the start of the film, represents, yes, he's anti-fascist. We know that, but we actually find that out afterwards. Initially, we think he's neutral.
Mm.
And at the start of World War II, that's essentially what America tried to be. Mm. But there would be little nods to the fact that they are actually anti-fascist. You know, they don't support the Germans, you know, in the real world. They support the English and the French. And like that in the film, it's like, you know, when Marseillaise is playing, or when it's about to play, Rick nods to the band, you know, I'm on this side. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to overtly sing with you guys. I'm not fully on your team, but I sympathize with that. I am an anti-fascist.
Mm.
And then progressively neutrality, which he so desperately seeks. I don't drink with customers. I don't do this. I play chess by myself. I don't talk politics. I run a bar. You know, that neutrality seeps away as he is confronted with events, you know, Ilsa walking back into his life. He has to take a side. And the side that he eventually takes is very anti-fascist. He literally kills a German. You know, the French help him do that. And he helps refugees from Europe escape fascism to the free world of America. Like, to me, that is so paintedly obvious, isn't it? But it doesn't hurt the film, like you say. You're right. It's just a sign of the times. But as I said, I'm just curious to see if that was actually in the play, or whether the play was more just like the setting, and then it was Koch that really imbued it with that political edge.
Having not read it, but what I've read about the play, like, it's very much in there. And like Burnett was inspired by his trip through Germany and whatever. By fascism and its impact it could have on the rest of the world. So it was very much, from my understanding, it was very much in there from the get-go. It probably wasn't quite as refined as what we've seen.
I don't know if you heard or read this, but in the 80s, I think it was, there was someone got hold of the original script for the play, Everybody Comes to Rick's, and showed it around to a bunch of studio heads to see if it could gain interest, essentially pitching this play. And a bunch of studio heads recognized it as you know, Casablanca, essentially. A bunch didn't.
Wow.
A bunch didn't recognize it. And they didn't green light it. They turned it down on the grounds that it was very much of its time. It wouldn't sell now. Not enough sex. Not funny enough. And it's just like, it's amazing to think that exists, right? That somebody could ever turn down the concept of Casablanca in a film. But how much work was done by those people, Epstein, Koch, Robinson, Curtiz, to turn it from something that was potentially unmakeable at some point in history to one of the greatest films ever is just amazing to me.
Oh, it's huge. And like all the memorable lines and everything like that came from the Epsteins and maybe Koch as well, I'm not too sure. Like none of that was in the original play. So it's like the play was just like the bare bones. It's almost like someone's just given you a bit of like an overview of a story and they've gone, cool, that's really great. Let's take all those things like the bar, the political intrigue, like the neutral locale. Let's take all that. And we'll just work into something better.
And that they did. It's a great movie. I think it's fairly safe to call it a great movie, don't you think?
It'd be hard-pressed to say it's not.
What particular factors are what makes it great? You'd say the screenplay, definitely. Bogart, Bergman. It's so deceptively funny. I think people... Mm. This movie is sold as a romance, but it is... It's honestly one of the funniest movies I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, and so much of that is down to delivery from Claude Rains. Like, that man gets the funniest lines in the whole thing. It's just ridiculous. I think my favorite is that... what's that? He goes to shut down Rick's, and he's like, why are you shutting this down? And he's like, I'm shocked. Shocked to find that there is gambling happening here. And then the guy walks
your over. Your chips, sir.
Yeah. Here's your winning, sir. He's like, oh, thank you very much. It's just beautiful. And, like, the way they've plotted it out, so you've got, like, was it Louis?
Yes.
Louis is Claude Rains. You've got Bogart as Rick. They're standing there in, like, a mid-shot. And then in the background, you can see the, like, you know, the gambling attendant just walking over slowly just as Claude Rains is delivering these lines and just perfectly just hands in his winnings. Oh, it's so brilliant.
Well, that's one thing I wanted to talk about a little bit that I think gets undersold a little bit, because everyone knows about Bogart, Bergman, and Rains, as you rightly say. Mm. He was nominated for an Oscar, didn't win. The screenplay obviously gets a lot of credit. Mm. It's so funny. It's so romantic. People love that about the film. What I find really curious is, so Arthur Edison is the name of the cinematographer.
Mm.
And I think he does an outstanding job, an absolutely outstanding job. And there's a bunch of things there. And I think in conjunction with Michael Curtiz, your example you just used just then, yes, the thing we notice so obviously is how funny that is. Mm. And that's down to the writing and the delivery. But there is also that physical comedy that you're talking about, that subtleness, that blocking, the mise-en-scene. So the way they've arranged that entire bit is so perfect and aids the comic delivery so elegantly and almost unnoticeably. I noticed the same thing. There was a number of times that I noticed the camera moving as well, in such a graceful and beautiful way. There would be times where like Ilsa and Rick are about to have the big, like, hill of beans conversation at the end of the film, and the camera just locks on them and then zooms in really quite quickly. Like, it actually doesn't zoom in, it dollies in, you know? And it's just like this wonderful moment, you know? And the close-ups, are just so, especially of Ilsa, just so, like, she's a wonderfully beautiful woman, Ingrid Bergman. No question about that. One of the most beautiful actresses ever. But her emotions, her face, when she cries, when she smiles, like, being able to lock in on that extreme close-up, and get that lighting exactly right, get those shadows across Rick's face exactly right. You know, like the cinematography, I adore the work of Arthur Edison in this movie.
There's a lot of, I noticed so much, like, soft lens work on, like, close-ups of Bergman. You know, it goes from, like, a two-shot, maybe like an over-the-shoulder where you've got Rick and you've got Ilsa, and then you cut to the close-up and suddenly everything's super soft. You know, it's that whole idea of putting, like, a lens cloth over it, or like a Vaseline on the lens to make the actress look much softer. And it's so there's a lot of it used in this film. It's great. There's little techniques that you don't see anymore. It's like, I mean, people get, you know, softened, but it's usually in post-production. But yeah, it just made me laugh. You go from, like, a very normal looking, like, beautiful two shot to just, like, close up, and she looks totally different.
Yeah, there's, like, there's almost like this glow, right?
Yes.
Like this, like she's angelic, like, yeah. And it's really part of that storytelling, right? The character building for her.
I mean, sort of. I mean, I laugh because I saw that as just, like, a contractual agreement. They're like, if I'm in a close up, make it soft, you know.
And get my best side.
Yeah.
Like, she is always looking left to right, you'll notice. Sorry, yeah. Right to left, like, as we see it.
Yeah.
So, I'm just like, I wonder if that was one of her things too. Like, that's her best side.
I'd say so for sure. Like, you just read into these, like, contractual agreements for actors and whatever. And it's so funny. And, like, you could argue that it's, like, it's character building for her. She's angelic. I'm like, I reckon it's just she wanted to look soft.
And hey, look, maybe. Whatever works as far as I'm concerned.
But, like, you talked as well about, like, the camera movements. That
yes.
And it's just, like, it is incredibly, incredibly smooth. And you see it replicated in future with, like, Spielberg is one of the best people for, like, getting it done in one, you know, rather than cutting. you let a scene play out, the camera just moves around. Like, he's done it to more an extent than this film, but like, there are some beautiful moments where just the subtle camera movement, where it's like, it could have been covered in like two or three shots. It's covered in one shot. Like, yes. when you mentioned it earlier, the hero shot when we first meet Rick, like, we've got like, yes, the looking down at the paper where he's signing the check, signs his name, and then the camera moves to his hand as he grabs his cigarette, and then it follows the cigarette up to his face, and we go, yes, boom, here he is. It's so goddamn smooth. And there's like another thing was like, we first see Rick and Louis speaking, and Rick walks into, he walks from like, from the bar into another room where he opens a safe. And I think he puts some money into the safe or something like that. And it's all in one shot. Like, we go through the set from like the room, and it just tracks across. He opens the door, we walk in, and it's totally different lighting set up. But it's so smooth. We could have, today that would be like so much coverage, but it's all just one shot that just tracks around.
Which is quite amazing considering, and again, remember the context. We're talking about a film that was made during World War II. Now, America was one of the great producers of weapons and other things for other countries during World War II, right? So, building supplies were of a premium, and there's a huge shortage. So, when it came to creating sets, you know, you had to get it right. The only set that was actually created for the film was Rick's. Everything else was a hand-me-down from some other film on the Warner Brothers lot. So the markets at Casablanca, Ferraris, all that, they were all just reused sets. So to get things exactly right on a strict time frame, they're making 50 movies a year. To get that cinematography, to get that level of planning with that blocking, that mise-en-scene, that camera movement in the 1940s. Like, it was very, very difficult to move a camera around in the 1940s compared to now, the Steadicams or whatever you want to use now. Like, it's very different. Just a monumental piece of filmmaking considering the context. Absolutely incredible.
That story of what you said about, like, Rick's bar being the only set, I think it was Rick's bar, but also whenever we see a bar, or most interiors, it was all Rick's bar. They just dressed it differently and moved the camera around.
So, like, Ferraris, for example, would have been probably also Rick's bar as a different part.
I think so. Or, like, when they're in Paris and they're in, like, the apartment, or they're in the bar and whatever. Like, I think that's all just different sections of Rick's bar just dressed differently.
Ah, interesting.
And that's the power of the old, you know, golden age of Hollywood, right? Like, the studio system, like, people were just so efficient because they're churning out, you know, what, a movie. No, they weren't churning out a movie a week, but there'd be a new film shooting every week. So it's like the teams just need to be right on it.
The team. I mean, we're talking about like Arthur Edison. He was just like a staff cinematographer, right? Owen Marks, the editor, staff editor, Max Steiner, someone on the Warner Brothers books, he made the music for this, using that wonderful As Time Goes By as like a motif throughout his score, you know, just wonderful stuff. Like, just, and it is melodramatic. There's lots of strings and pianos and stuff like that, but it is just so beautiful. You know, these are all people on the roster, on the payroll, you know, that are just creating an entertainment, which I think primarily it was meant to be, but also high art. Like the cinematography particularly, I just look at that and just go, wow, like, that's art. That is artistic. It's some of the best camera movement going around. And I love that you use Spielberg as an example, because he is one of the greats. I literally just watched West Side Story maybe a week or two ago, the new one that he created. And it's so interesting because the thing that he brings to a musical that's so different is that with a musical like America, right? Like that song in West Side Story, it's such an upbeat, energetic song. A lot of musical filmmakers would use that as an opportunity to get lots of cuts to match the rhythm of the song. But he uses a lot of wide shots, a lot of camera movement to try and capture the choreography more than anything, you know, to capture the set, to capture all of the movement, a bit like how John Wick captures a lot of the action more than quick cuts, you know, which has become fashionable in action movies. Spielberg uses camera movement and wide shots to capture the choreography of this musical, which, you know, has mixed results, I think. But he is one of the great camera movers. I've heard him talking about Casablanca and how he called it a masterclass of camera movement, quote.
Yeah, interesting.
So that's just, you know, that's high praise coming from someone that probably has done it better than anybody ever has.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, huge credit to, obviously, Michael Curtiz, working in conjunction with his cinematographer, Arthur Edison. Is there anything bad about Casablanca?
Hmm.
Or any shortcomings generally?
I think, like, I find most of the potency in the film comes in the first, like, 45 minutes. Like, for me, that hits the hardest. Like, that's the most emotional section. So, that's where we meet the world. We meet this, like, all this these different characters, like, all the side characters, which are so wonderful, all the refugees. We meet Rick. We meet Ilse at the 25-minute mark. And then that's just, like, heartbreaking from then until, like, halfway through. It definitely does, for me, start to drop off a little bit as we approach the end. I find it does get a little bit slow. It's really, this is like real small stuff, but where there's this like back and forth between like, should Rick help them? Should he not? It gets a little bit funny around some of those parts for me, a little bit slow. Definitely picks up again as we get closer to the end. Once Laszlo is effectively like being about to be arrested, like all that stuff is really great, but does sort of drop off a little bit. And there's definitely some sections in there where it is very much of its time. So, like, the character of Ilse, like, she seems like quite a strong person on the moral high ground. And it comes to that section where she's in Rick's apartment. And she basically just, like, gives up and just wants Rick to make the decision for her life.
Yes.
And that's, like, okay, not a great, like, portrayal of a strong woman there.
No, not the most feminist thing going around, is it?
No, it also just seems a little bit like too easy. Like she's just like, oh, make the decision for me. And he's like, well, yeah. I will be the man in this situation and sort this out for you. Don't you worry.
I couldn't imagine that happening with Madonna and Ashton Kutcher, to be honest.
No. I think Ashton Kutcher would be the one saying like, oh, make the decision for me, please.
And try and say it with a joke. Like, I think he was doing Punk'd at the time. My goodness. Oh, what a terrible idea.
What a time.
That's interesting. Like, I didn't have an answer to this question.
Yeah.
I couldn't really think of anything. Like, I don't know if I believe in perfect movies, but, like, this would be damn close.
Mm.
But you're right.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Like, for its time, the race politics are quite good. But that part maybe hasn't aged that well. It's aged a lot better than its contemporaries. Mm. But, you know, there's certain bits there that Carrot Blanca pointed out really well, as you said. Mm. There's certain parts of Ilse's behavior, like you say, that is fairly anti-feminist. Not anti-feminist, but, like, not the most feminist thing. But she's not the strongest character going around.
Well, I mean, it's, like, feminist or whatever. Like, it just didn't seem very human to me. Like, it didn't seem particularly real. Like, that's just, like, I just can't imagine too many people just being like, oh, I don't know, just make the decision for me. I give up.
That's my life.
it's like whenever we have a conversation.
Oh, Dan, I don't know. Please just make my decisions for me. It was very difficult for me having to cancel our New Year's Eve plans because I may have been in a close contact for COVID. So I went, oh, look, I'll just cancel things. But that was very big of me to take the lead on that, to be honest.
It was a big, it was up there. It was up there. Because, whatever happens between two people doesn't mean a hill of beans.
Speaking of fantastic lines, you mentioned your favorite earlier. I thought it was high time I mentioned mine. Mine is between Claude Rains and Rick as well. But mine probably isn't so much Claude's. It was Bogart. It's where Louis asks Rick, like, why he came to Casablanca. Mm. And Rick's like, my health. Yeah. I came to Casablanca for the waters. The waters, but we're in the desert. I was misinformed. Yeah. You're like, I love that.
It's beautiful. And as well, like, where Bogart's getting, basically interrogated by, like, the Nazi commander. And he's like, what's your nationality? And he's like, a drunkard.
Yeah.
But it's so natural. Oh. Like, in such, like, a melodramatic, like, overly performed. Like, I think a lot of these performances were quite subtle and quite strong. Like, Claude Rains is very, like, over the top, but he's great. But Humphrey Bogart is actually quite subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that delivery of that line, he kind of pauses, he looks down, then he looks up and just delivers it. Like, and he's obviously delivering it for a gag. But mm-hmm. it's this, like, that sort of person who doesn't like talking about himself and will just, like, deflect with a gag. And it's, like, it just says a lot about who he is with that line. And it was just beautiful. Yeah. Like, it's very – I've noticed a few times where in his performance where he's very, very subtle.
That was probably one of the most subtle – in terms of dialogue, actually, mm-hmm. the most subtle moments where they could have just been like, I'm American.
Mm.
Like, you know, for the propaganda. Mm-hmm. Like, but they decided not to go that one. In terms of subtle performances, I actually want to give credit to Paul Henreid, as well, the guy that plays Victor Laszlo. Mm-hmm.
Good Austrian.
I love his performance in this movie. He plays, you know, and there's so much confusion in among the actors about who Ilsa is going to end up with, how mm-hmm. this movie's going to end. Like, they didn't know. Mm-hmm. And they were sort of making it up as they went along. And by virtue of that, they all kind of play it down the middle, which I find so fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to give Henry a little bit of credit there. What do you make of that technique, by the way, of leaving the actors essentially in the dark about what their characters really are going to do at the conclusion of the film and letting them sort of play it down the middle because they sort of have to?
I don't know. I watched this and I thought, like, Ilsa's obviously in love with Rick. And she's kind of just like, she admires Laszlo, but she's in mm-hmm. love with Rick. The way she looks at him is so obviously like infatuation. It feels less down the middle for me.
So there is one of my favorite scenes is, as I've mentioned a bunch of times, where Laszlo encourages, while the German Nazis are singing Die Wacht am Rhein.
Good German.
He encourages, thank you. He encourages the French to sing La Marseillaise.
Checks his notes.
Yeah, sorry, I had to. You have no idea how many times I have looked up the pronunciation of Marseillaise, yeah. And I've still probably butchered it on YouTube. but there's that scene where he leads that so stoically.
Mm.
And then she, you see a close up of Ilsa's reaction to that. It looks like she, well, I sort of took it as love, but I guess what you're sort of seeing there is a kind of love, but maybe more admiration.
Yeah. It's like you, there's this figure who is almost bigger than human, like almost godlike in this world mm-hmm. and this political climate and everything. And so she's got pure admiration for this man. Like, she sees he's going to do great things, but she's got this infatuation with Rick. It's mm-hmm. different. It's very, very different feeling. Like, I see there's love with Rick, with Laszlo. It's almost like a father figure or something like that. You just look at them and you just admire. Well, it depends on your father, but you just admire them.
To go a little bit philosophy on you here, I think it was Nietzsche that said that there are so many different types of love. You know, like, I can love my partner romantically. I can love you as my best friend. I can love my cousin. I can love my dad. I can love my work. I can love a chicken burger from KFC.
Which you do.
I do, yes. And they all are true and they're all different types of love. And I guess what you're pointing to there is that, yes, she probably does love Laszlo. But the confusing thing for her is, like, what is the more honorable thing? She's already married the guy.
Mm.
right? She thought he was dead, so she moved on, fell romantically in love with somebody, but now she's stuck in a situation where she has to honor her marriage and a person that she does love, or choose romantic love, take that big leap, take that risk. The safe option, I mean, maybe not literally in terms of their life, but the safe option is Laszlo. You're already married to him. There is love there. The risky option is to take that leap to Rick, you know. What a fascinating thing that they had to sort of play down the middle there. I can see what you're saying, that she was leaning more towards Rick, which makes the ending even more potent and even more surprising, I think. Which, if we're rating the great scenes of the film, the ending has to be right up there for me.
It's an amazing scene. And, like, I think also down, like, there's a beautiful thing with that with, I think it's down to, like, the special effects team. So, a combination between the cinematographer and the special effects team was just making that plane look believable.
And I'd out say, of cardboard, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently, it was made out of cardboard and
they had, like little people were sort of the crew.
Yeah, to get the perspective right. And they just filled it full of smoke and just made it a rainy, smoky night. It's just gorgeous and it works so well. And, like, I think a beautiful thing with that as well, because I think that was, like, the last scene to be written. So, it's like they'd done majority of principal photography, but they didn't have an ending. And they actually didn't know, was she going to wind up with Rick? Were they all going to leave to America and there would be a sequel? Like, no one knew. And then I think it was, like, the Epstein brothers just turned to each other and said, this is probably just pure Hollywood fantasy, but they turned to each other and said at the same time, round up the usual suspects. And then that led to, like, well, this is what's going to happen. He's going to shoot, like, Rick is going to shoot the German man. Louis is going to back him up. And Ilsa and Laszlo will escape in a plane. And that'll be the ending.
Just like, again, one of those amazing moments of serendipity, right? Like, just complete, almost coincidence that it comes out of nowhere. They need an ending. They don't know how to do it. And then it just happens.
Yep.
It just comes to them. And then it becomes one of the great endings in cinema history.
Yes.
Who knew?
Yes. And, like, the beautiful line that we end on, which is, I think it's, I'm probably going to misquote it, but, like, Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
You've nailed it, yeah.
Yeah, was just a total wild take that they were just like, they finished the film, you know, everything was cut together, and they're like, you know what? We need one extra line. Actually, I think they recorded two extra lines, and they're going to see which one they wanted to use more. Obviously, they chose the right one. And just lay that in there, and that's the very final thing we get from the film, and it ends. It's perfect. It, even though Rick didn't get the girl, he's chosen the moral high ground, and it ends happy because they're like, okay, what are these two going to get up to now?
Do you reckon it would have been tempting? Like, okay, let's assume that this movie is made in 2021. How certain are you that there's a sequel?
Oh, 100%. Like, it wouldn't get off the ground without, like, a 5-picture deal. It'd be another series on Netflix.
Oh, yeah, it would be, wouldn't it? And then, oh, yeah, they would milk that cow like crazy. I'm glad they didn't. They did have a couple of serials, like they said, you said afterwards and stuff, but I'm glad they left it alone because it would have been tempting to be like, okay, so how are Rick and Louis going to survive this? Louis would be they both would be in a lot of trouble. Like, Rick literally shot a German high officer and Louis let it happen. They try and say that it's all good because it's like round up the usual suspects, but at the end of the day, they're going to get in a lot of trouble for that.
Yeah, potentially. But, like, what I think is so beautiful about these one-off films is, like, things are left unexplained and it's fine. Like, much like life, like, it's just, this story is a snippet of people's lives or these characters' lives. You don't need to know how the rest of their lives go. It's fine. There's this very dramatic thing that happened. It's over. We move on. We can all speculate over what happens to them after that. Really doesn't matter. Like, the most exciting part of that story is over.
It's the thing that biopics get wrong so often, is that they show too much of the person's life because you feel like you need to show all the person's life, but you don't. You just need to show the most pivotal part of their life or the most interesting for the film.
Yeah.
And little bits either side, maybe, but, like, the crux of it, the 90% of it needs to be this one bit, this one story, because like, my story is not one story. My life is a series of stories. Some are sad, some are happy. But you wouldn't tell them all in one two-hour movie.
No.
So, I totally agree with you. Like, things being left unsaid are awesome. I don't know if you can hear that barking in the background.
Yeah, it's fine. Dogs will be dogs.
Yeah, I've got dogs at the moment. I do want to quote what Roger Ebert said about this movie. Dialogue is so spare and cynical, it has not grown old-fashioned. Much of the emotional effect of Casablanca is achieved by indirection. As we leave the theatre, we are absolutely convinced that the only thing keeping the world from going crazy is that the problems of three little people do, after all, amount to more than a hill of beans.
Mm.
And I mean, he's a beautiful writer sometimes, mm-hmm. Ebert, but that was, that's kind of how I feel, right? Like Rick is right that three people don't matter more than the world, right? Like, the world is more important. The greater good is more important. It's so heroic and sacrificial and all of that. But tell you what, that hill of beans? No, like, you know, I'm all about that hill of beans.
Mm.
Like that is a great scene. Is that your favorite scene, by the way?
It's not, but like, it's such a beautiful quote because it's true. Like, obviously it does matter, a hill of beans, because otherwise we wouldn't still be talking about this film
80 years later. Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. It is a really beautiful scene, and it's one of the greatest endings of any film I think it's ever been made. Mm-hmm. It's definitely, like, it's hard to say what's a favorite scene, but, like, I can only talk about what I have the best, strongest, like, emotional reaction to. And for me, it's when Ilsa and Rick see each other for the first time. Like, that is my favorite scene.
Ah, yeah.
It's just so beautiful. And without, if you've never had any concept of their relationship together, they say so much in their looks, in the way it's been cut, that it's just, you get it instantly that there is a lot of history between them. It's just stunning.
I'm trying to remember the music of that part as well. Like, it feels like there's, like, strings, and they're really, like, ominous and kind of like a dun, you know, like a whoa,
mm-hmm.
like, there she is, right? Like, it's almost like inside Rick's head there was this nice music playing until he sees her, mm-hmm. and then it was like this record scratching, you know, yeah. Kind of moment. I don't know if that's actually true or whether I'm making that up, but it feels like that in my head, you know, like this ominous moment.
Totally. It's either that or it's silence. It was something to just break the pace. So it's like Rick's life had been going on pretty fine. He's just, like, running this successful business. He doesn't have to talk much about his life. Like, he's subtly helping people because, you know, he's built this place that people just go and do deals and whatever. Everything's kind of okay. But then something comes in that just rocks him. It just just disrupts his pace of life, and it comes in at the 25-minute mark of the film.
That you're right. That is a lovely scene as well. I also think too, of all the gin joints in all the towns of all the world, she walks into mine, and then that flashback scene to Paris.
Yeah,
and then she walks in, wearing what that white shawl, I think, almost in shadow, you know, just a wonderful, 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 wonderful scene.
Yeah.
We've talked about this before, how a great movie is three or four great scenes and no bad ones. This absolutely qualifies. There's just no question about that. You could point to any one of those scenes. And I mean, even just the little things like vouchers everywhere.
The amount of just, like, beautiful, just, like, side characters in this piece is incredible. Yeah. So, like, that opening scene where you talk about this guy who's, like, talking to these, like, British couple who's on holiday or something during war times.
Yeah, good time for it.
Yeah. And they do these big, like, so there's the police are running around and gating, like, agitators or suspects who potentially killed this German official and stole the transit papers. So they're trying to find out who did it. And you see the faces of all these people. And traditionally, you'd be like, oh, are they introducing key characters? Or even that Vultures guy, is this a key character? No, they're all bit characters, or they're just in there for a second. It's just they're all scene setters. And, like, I think that's a really beautiful part of this movie, is the amount of just awesome side characters. And, like, my favorite And it's probably a good thing that it was a propaganda film, is because it captured the energy of the time. And I think it was Curtiz who wanted to bring this in because he was arguably a refugee, I think. I think he was escaping Nazi regime at the time.
Yeah, he left Germany in 1926, so they weren't quite Nazi regime by that point, but maybe he saw the winds changing because they were.
Yeah, or at least he had family members who were. And he really wanted to bring in this idea of, like, the feeling of the refugees. Mm-hmm. And that's why there are so many wonderful characters. Like, you have that young Bulgarian couple with, like, the woman who will, you know, do anything to try and get enough money. She sleeps with – well, they allege that she sleeps with Claude Rains' character.
Well, she's going to. But she is saved from doing that by the luck at the roulette table.
Okay. I took it as she'd already been doing it and it didn't really lead to anything. And then her husband is trying to, like, gamble the money because he's a fucking idiot. But he's just trying to do his best. But then you've got, like, the wonderful, like, I think of them as, like, the Swiss couple. They may not be Swiss, but it's just the way that this, like, old man says, Gott sei Dank. And I'm like, that's a Swiss person. And they're like,
what watch?
Yeah.
10 watch.
It's so beautiful. And I remember the first time I saw that and I was like, what are they doing? I don't get it. That was a weird segue. But, like, they're trying to, like, capture the idea of, like, these people who try to go to a new country and they're trying to speak the language and they just don't quite get it. Like, they obviously aren't native speakers, but they're trying their best. They're like, when we go to America, we'll only speak English. But the funny thing is, like, they will make little mistakes like that. It's captured perfectly.
Such much?
Yeah. such much.
What watch? 10 watch. Such much?
Yeah.
You'll fit in brilliantly in America.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. But then, like, and then when you first get into Rick's bar, you just see these little, like, montages of, like, people doing deals and trying to work out. Like, it's all scene setting, but they feel real. And it's just something like, apparently they were quite real because a lot of these people who played these bit parts were, like, well-known actors back in Europe who came to America as refugees and were enlisted to do these bit roles. And so, like, they're all really strong actors.
And a lot of the extras are genuinely, like Jewish people that fled Europe as well. Mm. Yeah, like, you've got a lot of emotion in that room, and I keep talking about the scene where they sing the French national anthem. Like, there's so much emotion in that room because that is a really meaningful symbol to them, you know, to stand up to a German song that was sung a lot during the Franco-German War.
Mm-hmm.
And turn it into, no, this is the French national anthem. This is revolution. This is a chance for us. This is victory. This is strength. Just honestly, there's so many ingredients. And, like, we've talked about romance. We talked about comedy. We talked about politics. And it has still aged so well. It's really remarkable. I do want to play a little game with you, Dan. This game is, we mentioned right near the top that, AFI, the great emo band of the mid to early 2000s, made a list of 100 great quotes in American cinema, and Casablanca
is very good of them.
Very good of them. I mean, I can appreciate a list maker as much as the next person. And I don't necessarily agree with the entire list, to be honest, but Casablanca had 6 entries. Dan, I want to see how many of those you can guess.
Yeah.
So, which 6 quotes, and I will permit you to open up, you know, a tab on your computer or whatever to see the quotes if you want to, if you need the help, but I don't think you will. I think you'll get at least half.
Yeah, I think I can rattle off at least 3 or 4 of them, and the rest, but there's so many good quotes that it's like I might not quite hit it, but.
All right, so first one, let's just say Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Comes in at number 20.
Yep. On the list. He's looking at you, kid, because that's repeated at least 50 times in the film.
Yep, it comes in, not 50 times, but it comes in at number 5. It probably is said about 5 times. Yeah, but yeah, so they're the top 2.
Yeah. Okay. I might have to pull up the tab. Hold up. This pressure is getting to me. The drunkard line?
No.
Oh.
No. So nothing funny.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so like my favorite one about the waters in Casablanca, mm-hmm. not in there.
Okay.
Your favorite about the gambling? Shocked. Not in there. Think
okay.
iconic more than funny.
Okay. Round up the usual suspects.
Yes.
For
that
sure.
comes in at number 32.
Kiss me as if it were the last time?
No.
Oh.
That one didn't make the list.
Okay. So what have I got? I've got three so far.
You've got three. You've got Here Looking at You, Kid, Louis, I Think This Is the Beginning of a Beautiful Friendship, and Round Up the Usual Suspects.
Yeah.
There is another one that is... So, basically, the three that you've got right so far are basically from the ending,
mm-hmm.
or at least mentioned in the ending.
Mm-hmm.
There is another one right at the end with Rick and Ilsa that Rick says.
Oh, so the Hiller Beans... stuff.
No.
No? Like, really?
No. The Hiller Beans didn't make it.
Wow.
I know, right? That's what I'm starting to question whether this random emo band from the early 2000s was really the best people to be making this list.
They're a very, very good band, but anyway.
The quote that I'm referring to there is, "We'll always have Paris."
Ah. Well, that's a nice
That
one.
Came... That came in at number 43. I'll give you another clue. This one is often misquoted, and it comes from Ilsa.
Okay.
It's quite early in the film. When we first see her, actually.
Well, she's talking to Sam?
Mm-hmm.
Play it again, Sam?
Yes. So,
that's a misquote?
That's the misquote.
Yeah.
The true quote is... Play it, Sam.
Yeah.
Play
yes.
as time goes by.
Yeah.
That comes in at 28. And there is one more. I have said it during the podcast so far.
Mm-hmm.
It is when...
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
It's after Rick has seen Ilsa,
mm-hmm.
and he's quite upset.
Mm. Oh, yes. That in all the gin joints of all the world... Blah, 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 blah.
She walks into mine.
Yeah.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns and all the world, she walks into mine.
Yes.
Now, obviously, I take issue with some of these. I think We'll Always Have Paris is not quite as memorable as the Hiller Beans.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see some more comedy ones in there too, because they are classics.
Mm.
But they are the six. You got three unassisted. Well done.
Thanks.
That was pretty tough.
It was. There's so many wonderful quotes. It's a big one. And I guess, like, how are they grading that? Is it, like, the proliferation, like, the usage of it? Because, like, We'll Always Have Paris. I imagine that's been used a million times.
I think it comes down to, like, how iconic the quotes are. Like, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn is probably one of the most iconic, you know, like, or Toto, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like, super iconic lines. Here's Looking at You, Kid. Very much amongst those.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think a few of those are very worthy. Gin joints in all the towns in all the world.
Mm.
Like that one, I like.
Mm.
Not in love with We'll Always Have Paris being on there, but that's a small gripe. I'm happy that it gets recognition.
It's nice though, because it's a lot of potency in that line.
Mm.
It's like no matter what happens, they had that period of time where they were in love.
Yes, let's hold on to our happy memories and do what's best for the greater good.
Yes.
is basically the subtext there. Dan, we're getting close to the end of the podcast. Who is the MVP of Casablanca?
It's a really hard one. Like, there's so many wonderful players, and I love how this filmed. It was just like almost accidentally brilliant. It's one of those, like, there were so many pieces of art where it's almost just like a blip in the matrix where things just happen and they were just amazing and you can never be repeated. Like, I think of that with, like, Nas's Illmatic. Like, he's had a wonderful career, but, like, he's never going to be able to make a better album. Like, this film, like, it was never meant to be good, or at least it was never meant to be great, and it just was, because all the right pieces work together. So everyone is just a wonderful player in this. The writers, composer Max Steiner is just so incredible. You could argue that as time goes by, could be the MVP. Curtiz, maybe, but I think it would have to be the writers, like all of them together somehow made.
So
the screenplay is the MVP.
Yeah, well, that's where I landed too. I was very tempted with Arthur Edison, the cinematographer, Michael Curtiz as a director, Bogart, shit. Like, come on. Like, this is like quintessential Bogart. But screenwriters, Julius and Philip Epstein, Howard Koch, and the uncredited Casey Robinson, I think you've got to give it to them. I totally agree with you.
Yep, I think so for sure. It's like, it's hard to say. Like, Humphrey Bogart was brilliant. Ingrid Bergman was amazing, but I feel like they were just doing their thing, you know. They weren't trying to make anything particularly, maybe they were, maybe, but it's by the sounds of it, like, apparently Ingrid Bergman was quite surprised that this is the film she's known for.
Yeah, they hated it, right?
Yeah, well, I don't know if they hated it, but she was, maybe you've heard differently, but she was just surprised that she thought, like, For Whom the Bell Tolls or something like that, that would be the film she'd be remembered for.
See, when I think of her, I definitely think of Casablanca, and then my second would be Notorious, Alfred Hitchcock's Notorious. Mm-hmm. She's wonderful in that, with Claude Rains as well, too, in that film, and Cary Grant. But, I heard that Bogart and Bergman both didn't want to make that movie, Casablanca. They both was, like, really not digging it during the production.
Yeah.
They kind of reluctantly just did it, which is probably how they ended up just playing versions of themselves and play them damn well.
Well, I mean, that probably worked to great effect for Rick as a character, for Bogart, because he did not want to be there, like Rick. Like, he's quite like a dark, brooding man. Like, if he was just like, fuck, I am so happy to be here, I just want to work on this, make this amazing, probably wouldn't have had the same effect. And maybe that's why he feels so natural, because he clearly did not want to be there.
Like, he was a prisoner in Casablanca and on the Warner Brothers lot.
Yes. During those, 59 days of shooting.
I heard that his wife at the time, he was very famously married to Lauren Bacall later in his life, when he met her on, I think it was The Big Sleep. But he was married to somebody else at this time. I can't remember her name. And she was famously jealous whenever he had, like, an opposite leading lady. Yeah. And if you're going to be jealous of anybody, wouldn't you be jealous of Ingrid Bergman? My goodness.
Well, she was an interesting choice, though, at the time. Because, I mean, well, like, when she popped up on screen, I was like, oh, she's, like, she's beautiful, but she's kind of, like, not glamorously beautiful. Like, she's just, like, very naturally beautiful.
Humanly beautiful.
Humanly beautiful. Whereas, like, at the time, I think most people, like, most, you know, starlets or whatever you refer to them at the time, were just very glamorous, very big, very obviously, like, unattainable goddesses, whatever. But she seemed very natural, very, very, like, almost girl next door, I guess, like, something like that.
Well, and there was all that backstory about the fact that she wasn't a Warner Brothers employee as well, so they had to trade, I think it was Olivia de Havilland, to Ingrid Bergman's studio so that they could use Olivia for somebody who was also beautiful, but in a very natural kind of way. So they could have Ingrid, and it's just like, well, imagine if they just use Olivia de Havilland in this movie. She's very famously from that Robin Hood movie I mentioned earlier. She was also in Gone with the Wind, you know, so she was like a wonderful actress, very well known.
Is she American?
With Ingrid? Yes. I think that was part of the reason why they went with Ingrid, was because they wanted to have a European. And she had done some work in Sweden, I believe, prior to Casablanca and prior to her American movies. So I think they wanted to go with a little bit of authenticity there, which is why, you know, Victor Laszlo was Austrian. You know, the German guy Strasser, he was a German as well.
Actually German.
Claude Rains, I think he's English, I think.
He's English. Sure. I think I couldn't quite get to the bottom of this, but like, so I know originally the character of Ilsa was not Swedish or European. She was like European. She was American. I'm not quite sure if they cast Ingrid Bergman and then decided that the character was Swedish. Like, I don't know if that's the case or not, or if she was always European, or if she was like, because Rick is really the only American in this film, I think.
Very deliberately so, yeah.
Yeah. But I have a feeling, like, I think, and I could be very wrong, but maybe they made her European once they cast Ingrid Bergman.
I think I heard the other way around, but, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised either way. Mm. And, like, such is the lightning in a bottle kind of serendipity of this movie, it wouldn't shock me if they landed on her from another studio and then thought, well, she's kind of Swedish, let's make her European. And then it's like, oh, wow, now Rick really becomes this symbol of America. And, like, you know, and then it enhances the movie even further, you know. Like,
totally. That sounds like a perfect example of just how this film is just, like, how it just changed throughout production. Like, I read something about, or I heard something, Humphrey Bogart didn't like the character of Rick. He said he was too cold. Because, like, he had all this backstory in the screenplay, but once it got to scripting stage, they pulled all of that out. And he's just like, no, look, he's like this self-loathing, dark, brooding character with no backstory. Like, I don't like this person. He's unsympathetic. And the brothers, the writers.
Julius and Philip Epstein.
Yes, yes. So they took that feedback on board and were like, okay, cool. Well, let's try and weave in some backstory. And it's all, it's subtle. It's all been alluded to. Like, you know that he worked in the Spanish
Civil War. Yeah,
War. But on the side of the Allies. Like, they hint at some background of him being kind of like this agitator, subversive character on the side of the Allies, anti-fascism.
Yes.
And through that, you just get this little understanding of, like he becomes a very sympathetic character and you understand why he's so dark. But it's little things like that where you just see, like, I love how this film just evolved through good feedback.
Kind of organically, right?
Yes.
Like a living, breathing organism.
And, like, I did hear some beautiful things, like, right at the end, just to, like, you know, a couple of little fun facts to wrap things up. So it's like...
You and your fun facts.
I love it. Once the film was finished and, you know, it was finished being edited and whatnot, they started sending it out to different studios and all heads or whatever for just so they could see it. And I think, like, the American military, whoever was, you know, the head of that, not the president, saw it and was like, oh, this is great. Look, let's try and weave in some very current themes so we can tie it in with what's happening right now to make it very prescient. And maybe it was Warner, someone who was in charge of the film wrote back and said, look, doing that would ruin the film. Like, the way it is currently, it'll just, if you change that now, it'll just be a mishmash of things. It's so close to being done. It's perfect. It's already a propaganda film. Let's just release it and get it out into the world without having to change it. And thank God they didn't change it, because, yes, that would push the... So when we're talking about, like, is it obvious that it's a propaganda film? Yes. But, like I said, it was just a wrapper. It was just the thing to just wrap it all together and go, here we go, let's just package this up and send it out. It's a bit of propaganda, but the meat and bones is this. If they did this whole thing where it's like the Americans were all in their uniform and they were going out to fight the war, and that would just push it over the top.
Yes, yeah. And then, you know, Madonna and Ashton Kutcher come in and...
Yeah. Yeah. Madonna heard all this bit of feedback and she's like, yes, I will make this perfect film.
Oh, man. Look, suffice to say that the Madonna Ashton Kutcher version wouldn't have held up. Suffice to say the military intervention in the film wouldn't have held up. Does Casablanca hold up?
100%. Like, Casablanca ties into some very human themes and idealisms that were relevant at the time and they're relevant today. And I think hopefully they always will be. Like, it is just a stunning film that I hope will forever be highly regarded and watched with love, and you'll, you know, 100 years down the track, 200 years down, like we're at 80 years, like 100 years isn't much of a stretch. Like, you'll still be crying at the right bits. You'll still be laughing at all the right bits.
I think, and for anyone that's hesitant to watch it, if you've listened this far in the podcast, I would soothe your mind with the fact that, yeah, it's not just, like, it is genuinely funny.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Like, genuinely funny. Like I can't think of many movies that are funnier than Casablanca. And it just breezes by. That 102 minutes just flies. It's wonderfully paced. It's so, so funny. Has that central love story. It has a political edge. Some of the greatest characters ever. Wonderful craft work by, like, you know, not the craft work. They're German. But
yeah, a wonderful soundtrack by Kraftwerk.
Oh man, can you imagine?
That would be the, like, Madonna
instead
version.
Of Max Steiner. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Madonna, Ashton Kutcher, and just Alto Bahn playing the 23-minute version of it.
Wonderful. And there's, like, another thing. Like, I heard this with Ebert talking over the commentary for the film. He was talking about, like, how much smoking is a part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, it's all for your health, whatever. But, like, it's cool because it gave the actors something to do with their hands. And, like, I remember there's one scene where Laszlo's sitting there with Ilsa, and he's watching something happening, and he's just sitting there just, like, smoking, but, like, he just looks very active, and it's, like, very busy and very, like, interesting.
Like, dynamic?
Yeah, very dynamic. Like, there's, like, he's looking, but he's also moving his hands and smoking. Like, it gives them something to do. It gives them an action that feels natural. And it's like, it's we'd never see this anymore, because I think there was a period where smoking was just flat out outlawed in films. But it's a wonderful thing for actors to have something to do. That's like a secondary action.
It's something that I guess I haven't given much thought. But you're right. Instead of just sitting there, they have to do something with their bodies. There has to be some physical acting, doesn't there? Or it doesn't have to be, but it sort of helps to make the scene more dynamic. And I guess if you're just flailing your hands around for no reason, you're kind of like the wacky arms inflatable man out the front of the car dealership. It doesn't have much rhyme or reason, but if you're smoking, at least you have a purpose.
But it reminds me of, like, this little anecdote that I heard with like a young Tarantino trying to get his actors to deliver dialogue in a natural way. And so he's working with these people, and they're just like, just hamming it up, just like a big performance. And he's like, here, like, gave him a sandwich. He's like, eat this while you're trying to deliver your lines. And it's like, you cannot, like, overperform a line if you're eating a sandwich. Like, you have to sort of, they have to weave a bit of naturalness in at the time. And that's kind of like what smoking does as well. Like, you have something to do with your hands. Like, it grounds you a little bit, I think.
I'm just sort of picturing, like, like, during the end of Gone with the Wind, where it's just like, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. And he's, like, holding, like, a Subway footlong.
just frankly, my dear. I don't give a damn.
I don't give a ham. You know, it's like, ah, damn it.
Yeah,
damn.
Sponsored by Subway.
Well, better for the brand than Jared Fogle is. But anyway, Dan.
Oh, who's that? Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, that guy. Oh, let's not look him up on the internet. Dan, thank you so much for joining me today. We were planning on obviously recording in the same location, but I literally just found out that I am COVID negative. So I was isolating as a precaution that I didn't need to do, but I'm glad that I did it anyway, just in case. But we're doing it over Zoom and it's been fun. So thank you very much. What's happening in Dan Rice's world at the moment? Any projects at the moment or, with Breeder or how's Good Moves TV going?
So what's going on with me? Man, I'm on holiday, so not a whole lot, but there's lots of good things coming up. So keep an eye out on Good Moves TV. Like, we're always delivering a selection of just the greatest pieces of animation daily. Not right now. We're on holidays. We'll be back at it again on the 10th. Delivering up hot animation on the reg.
And it is hot. It is hot. Like, there is some seriously good stuff. I love following that page.
Yeah. Hashtag hot motion. I started that. and as for like what I'm doing with Breeder, just keep an eye out on the Breeder website, breeder.studio or at Breeder Studio, for all of our latest work. There's lots of exciting things coming up next year. Lots of things I wish I could talk about, but I can't.
Oh, okay. Hush, hush. Very secret. Hush, hush. Okay. I respect it. I respect it. It makes you sound very important, you know, Dan.
Oh, actually, there's one thing that we've worked on recently that maybe fans of this would like, because I think the part of this network, you said there's lots of like sci-fi fans, Star Trek fans and whatnot.
Heaps, yeah, yeah.
So if anyone's a fan of The Expanse on Amazon, Breeder has done the opening titles for that since season one. So we wrapped that up months ago and that's all now streaming on Amazon. I think they're doing like a slow launch of each episode. There's only six episodes, so they're gradually releasing everything. So if you're a fan of The Expanse, check that out and check out our opening titles for that.
Yeah, congratulations on your work for that. Do you get like a credit at the end of the show for that?
No.
Or does Breeder get the credit?
No, it's so weird. I don't know.
Right. So
I'm not sure why.
So you could be just like lying to us right now. It's like, yeah, we also did the opening credits for Fight Club,
yeah,
and Seven, and
totally, but I'm not. But like next year, we're doing a bit of a. So we've already got like a breakdown on our website for our work on season five, and next year we're going to do another case study that breaks down. It's basically an overview of seasons 1 to 6. So you'll be able to see all the work that went into creating those titles.
Fantastic. I'll put that all in the show notes for everybody, by the way. My podcasts are Movieversaries, which we're doing right now. Academy Watch, which is 2 episodes deep. It's basically a chance for me to keep an eye on the trends for the Oscars to see who's going to prevail at the end of the season, which will be like April this year. And meanwhile, we review and do a deep dive on some of the films that will be big players. The most recent episode I did with Ashley Thomas, the nerdy blogger, it was about The Power of the Dog, which is on Netflix. I strongly recommend it. Anyone that's into Westerns or anti-Westerns, anyone that likes Benedict Cumberbatch, he's wonderful in it. Kirsten Dunst, Cody McPhee, Jesse Plemons. I mean, it's directed by and written by Jane Campion. It's just wonderful stuff. Really fantastic movie. It's a genuine front runner for Best Picture this year. So check out Academy Watch. If you have seen The Power of the Dog and listened to my conversation with Ashley Thomas, the nerdy blogger, I also do a podcast called Pretty Fly, which is a 90s nostalgia podcast. It's on a bit of a hiatus at the moment. My co-host, Daniel Lang, is very busy at work and he has a baby on the way as well. So I'm not sure when that will kick off again, but
he should be on holidays. I think he's lying to you.
He's a very, very busy man in the corrections system in New South Wales. So I assume he is quite busy. So I like, you know, but you know, if we want to put it on the record that Daniel Lang is a liar, I'm all for it. And I'll be sure to send it to him as well.
Yeah. Look, I like to believe that there is only one Daniel in your life. So this man is a liar.
His entire existence is a lie. He's like the cake in Portal, you know, he's just a lie. Dan, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you so much, mate. And thank you, Casablanca, for being amazing.
Yes, thank you, Casablanca. And thank you to everyone who has tuned in to listen to this episode. We very much hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have, please subscribe to Movieversaries and give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Movieversaries is a product of the We Made This podcast network, and if you've enjoyed this, there's a good chance you'll enjoy a bunch of our other shows, which you'll get a preview of in just a moment. If you want to help out our network, please consider supporting us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/wemadethis. Thanks again for your company, and see you for the next installment of Movieversaries.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Academy Watch.
I saw West Side Story actually the other day, and I didn't really connect with it. So, you know, some I'll like and some I won't. But generally, I like the idea of a musical. Disney films, the animated Disney films, tend to enjoy them.
Of course. Are you a La La Land person? Because I was a La La person.
I hate La La Land. I just could not stand it.
Wow. We can't be friends anymore. I'm just going to hang on. How do I turn this thing off?
Yeah. I've lost a lot of friends over this opinion, but I hate it.
Garfield is the best Spider-Man and La La Land is shit. Like, what?
I just like to be controversial.
We dig music. But yeah, just missed out on my list this year. There was the Garbage record was great, so I got head off that.
Yeah, I was surprised that didn't end up on the main.
It was close.
I was surprised to not see it.
Wet Leg, who have released two songs so far. There's another one apparently coming out
terrible
later
band
this week.
Name.
Yeah, I can't get behind it. That's what our old history teacher was called, Mr. Wet Leg. It's actually Westlake, but like, apparently he pissed himself once.
Amazing. Yeah, it's a fucking terrible band name, but they're great.
It's like if Wet Leg toured with pissed jeans. Can you imagine?
Right in the childhood.
When I was younger, Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man looks way older than I was as a kid.
He looks older than you do now.
Way older than I am. Yeah, and that was a constant thing in the cartoons as well. Like in the cartoons, like the 90s one, he looked older. Mm. And that was the cartoon I watched when I was younger, was the 90s one. And we would have done that for the show. But as soon as Disney Plus came out, I binge watched it all. And then I encouraged you to watch it.
Yeah, and I've watched
and
it
then
as well.
And then we started the podcast.
And we were like, oh shit, we should have saved
that
it.
That should have been it. And then there was another one with Neil Patrick Harrison, which I probably did.
What, as in Doogie Howser MD?
Yeah, and you know,
Barney Ooh, Spencer. I'm going to put that on my list.
A Doogie Howser.
Doogie Howser MD.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.